this is Karen Schomer, formerly of The Schomer Show. You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need, and it is either a Macintosh 2011 or newer 2.0 GHz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer 2.4 GHz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info@wgxc.org for more information.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Laura Kunruther of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel.
Hello, everybody. My name is Eric Klein.
And we're going to talk about sound today. There's been some news in podcasting land. And
you mean radio on the internet that's on demand?
Exactly. However you want to put it. And for those who don't know, I do work a day job in the podcasting industry. So it's something that I do follow, and I have to actually note that I owe Radio Survivor for having a job in the podcasting industry. It is the fact that I was observing podcasting and writing about it at radiosurvivor.com going back nearly 6 years ago, and one of the few people looking at it from a business angle, the business of podcasting, trying to understand the political economy of podcasting, that work got the attention of Earwolf and Midroll co-founder Jeff Ulrich, who eventually hired me to work there. And I've been working there ever since. We are now known as Stitcher.
My favorite way to tell people about that origin story, I hope you don't mind if I blab.
You may.
Paul Rees-Mandel was a guest on a podcast that nobody listened to about the business of podcasting.
Like 1,000 people who all very big hoot.
There was this comedy podcasting network that had some very popular shows, some of the coolest podcasts of the previous decade. When the space was a lot less crowded, and I was a big fan of those podcasts. And then this podcasting network, Earwolf, had one show about the business of podcasting that was
called The Wolf Den.
That was so much like mind-blowingly boring compared to all of the comedy, all of the fun.
Well, not boring.
Right, like adult.
Yes.
Like adult, boring, but in a way, like boring is not a bad thing for a radio show to be.
Alex Bloomberg.
In the weeds.
Of Gimlet fame, of Planet Money fame, right, of This American Life fame, credits listening to The Wolf Den for helping him launch his networking company,
Gimlet. Yeah, it was Gimlet. Great. It was, you know, talking about it now in 2019 makes it seem it's a little bit silly, but in 2009, when Wolf Den would have been founded, roughly, I don't know.
No, several, many years
2012,
later.
2012. Sometime around that era of podcasting being so brand new on the earth, to have a podcast that was about the business of podcasting was itself a very fresh idea. Mm-hmm. Like, original.
And that's not even why he started it.
And what made it great was it wasn't just two guys who liked podcasts talking about podcasts every day. Every week was a new guest.
Yeah, and that's what it developed into.
Who knew something completely different than the last person who came on. And those people, gosh, can people hear these episodes?
Yeah, they are all there. I think we've took them out from behind the paywall, I think actively.
Now it's historically speaking, the history of podcasts is all
Alex
there.
Alex Bloomberg talking about his ideas for starting a podcast network before he did.
And that podcast network, for people who aren't insiders,
is called Gimlet.
Gimlet, which was recently purchased by Spotify for $200 million paycheck.
Yes.
That's kind of the biggest paycheck in podcasting last year.
Within the last year, yeah. It was this year.
But so Paul Riismandel was a guest on The Wolf Den, and following being interviewed by his future boss, he was hired to work in podcasting.
Yes.
Big podcast.
So just kind of...
Radio Survivor came first.
Yes.
The radio show that you are listening to now, the podcast that you are listening to now, was a few weeks old before. Paul was giving me a quizzical look because we got to look at a calendar.
I don't think that's true. No, it's not true.
There's a fuzzy line.
No, there isn't.
But okay, so we weren't on the air, okay. But I had met you and we were talking about doing the show.
Okay.
Like,
yeah, no, we started talking about the show.
It was close.
Very, yes. No, I agree.
It was like simultaneously close in
I think
a fuzzy
way. We first met probably about the fall of 2013.
And even though they weren't recorded and they didn't go out on the air,
that's right.
Either on the internet or on the radio, our initial conversations about launching a podcast called Radio Survivor, those conversations were basically episode -1 and episode -2.
Fair enough.
They felt pretty much the same as you and I having coffee and sitting in front of microphones. Anyway, Paul works in podcasting at Midroll.
Yeah, it's just I want to lay out why I know these things, why I follow them, and also want to lay out that I've been following the news around podcasting since the founding of Radio Survivor and before that, so going back to 2009 and earlier.
Not to mention your roots in community radio, in college radio, and your podcast before the RSS technology was invented, your on-demand streaming radio program that was also a college radio station?
No, it was community radio station at WEFT in Champaign-Urbana. It was called Media Geek. You can find it still, the archives, at radio.mediageek.net.
From the year 2000, right?
From the year 2002.
Which is a handful of months prior to this whole thing they call podcasts.
I would post them up
available
online, and then I syndicated it, much in the way that Radio Survivor is now syndicated to non-commercial stations that wish to air it.
Right. So anyway.
And the reason why we talk about podcasting here at Radio Survivor is because...
Radio on the internet.
It is radio on the internet, because it is also a very accessible medium. It's very easy to get started in. And as interest in audiences grow, we see that that's a more manifest opportunity for more voices, more diversity. Some people get worried. They say, oh, all these big companies are coming in and spending a lot of money and they're squeezing us out.
Well, because if you're from Gen X, you've seen, and I mean, if you're or a millennial who studies history, you've seen how bad things can go for a cool industry when the money shows up.
Yeah, you're worried, like, you know, when your favorite band in the 90s got a major label contract and it never seemed to be the same afterwards.
Or like when the city that you enjoyed living in, working part-time and being in a band, all of a sudden gets cool enough that the condos show up and now you can't afford to live there anymore.
Right.
So can podcasts get gentrified when Spotify and iHeartMedia show up?
You know, and the
answer is no, it's not a zero-sum game.
It's not a zero-sum
game. There's an infinite... It's not like the radio dial. It's not like real estate in your cool city. There's enough space for everyone to have a podcast. It's just an attention economy, really.
It really is. And you know, podcasts can take up that time that people might listen to radio, listen to broadcast terrestrial radio, can take up that time that they might listen to music. And in many cases, I think for a lot of people, it takes up, it's fresh. Like, I don't even know that it's a zero sum game on attention, because when I've talked to folks who've gotten recently turned on to podcasts, often they're like, oh, it was great because, you know, I like to garden, or I would do it. I like to walk, or it took up, you know, when I really wasn't having anything occupying my attention.
Someday we'll talk about
we found something to occupy my attention.
As a parent of a podcasting fan who is also a middle school teenager, sometimes I'm like, man, sometimes it's okay to have nothing in your head.
Sure.
It's nice to have nothing, but that's not how the podcast industry needs it. I'm going to have a podcast that's all silence, and I'm going to sell it as the mindfulness podcast, and it's just going to be like, hi, everybody. Like,
you might not be the first one.
You are welcome to just turn everything off. Here, I'm going to give you 45 minutes of silence.
This 45 seconds of silence is brought to you by a mattress in a box.
You know, another funny thing about podcasts these days is I think that radio people, if you're listening to our voices either as a podcast or on the radio on a low power FM or a community radio station around the country, you're a radio person. You like radio. You've been listening to the radio in your life. There are some people in our culture now that aren't radio people, especially the youngsters. And now podcasts come along and sort of teach them how to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so.
And teach them how to listen to, I think, a form that in many ways lie dormant.
Yeah.
You know, talk radio of sorts, both news talk, you know, so whether it's strict news, topical discussion, or into the sort of more kind of form of talk that is sort of all over the place, magazine style. Was sort of in recession.
Yeah.
And through the 80s and
culturally,
90s. Culturally.
Like, the literature of talk radio, I like to call it. I like to think about it that way, where people are, they're not as smart as Faulkner, right? But they're thinking out loud, they're writing with their voices. And if you think about the whole universe of talk radio, I think about it as like a body of work, even though it's so ephemeral, it's mostly missing
from
the
history
record. When I was
like in my
record.
Early 20s, I didn't know a single peer who listened to public radio, who said, I listened to NPR.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was older that I start to meet some folks who did. And it was the sense that something like All Things Considered wasn't for us.
Yeah.
It was for people who were 45 driving their Volvos
college
to work.
Graduate, you know, upper middle.
And a very musty sort of sense. And I think that indeed the programming itself was kind of musty. And it wasn't until sort of a new guard of public radio producers like Ira Glass, who began practicing his craft with This American Life in 1995. But at the time, I mean, we say that he really was avant-garde. People complained about his voice. They complained about his style.
Yeah.
A lot of program directors said, would not take it on.
I think another thing that to think about is as far as the culture of talk radio, the literature and how it was in decline for a couple decades. I just think that, they were never hiring certain people to do the talking. And that's what's so beautiful about podcasts is that everybody gets a turn to have a voice, everyone who can do it, and so many more people can than 50 years ago. But also just the number of chairs that were available where you could make a career out of sitting down and getting a broadcasting career going was shrinking over the decades.
Colleges and universities are adding podcasting classes and certificates now, and they may be adding programs down the line.
Talk radio is alive and well again, and they call it podcasts.
I mean, that's really what it is. And I think that's great in particular for college and community broadcasting, because talk programming has continued to have a home in these venues, even as it virtually disappeared off of the FM dial on commercial radio.
Yeah.
And was really became very marginalized on the AM dial to either basically sports talk. Right.
God bless sports talk.
Because you need to have live human beings
gross.
To call a game.
The way that right wing talk radio.
Or you need to have human beings who can, you know, talk about games. And then, mostly right wing conservative talk radio. It's not in some major cities in the U.S., there's still some kind of middle of the road AM, like WGN or WLS in New York, where they carry some Rush Limbaugh, but then they also have their own native shows that are just kind of variety talk.
Not explicitly like pushing a kind of insane social movement.
Yeah, either which way.
Now
right?
Live within, deep within.
But even those have kind of faded away over the years. The idea that you could talk about any number of things, right, broadly, outside of public radio, really.
Call-in radio shows about gardening.
The torch was carried, I think, by college and community radio in the spirit of it didn't have to be this highly polished to the extent to which it was almost too clean, but also devoid of character, devoid of voices that didn't meet the standard Midwestern American broadcast accent.
Yeah.
That's where you would hear it. If you wanted to hear, you know, somebody who is an actual union member or laborer talking about labor issues rather than a commentator who may never have picked up, you know, a hammer or a wrench or ever served, you know, ever actually did hard labor, you would hit on a community radio.
Community radio kept the torch alive for a variety of talk, a voice, a kind of voice, especially in the 80s and 90s.
And I think college radio, too.
Yeah.
You know, an opportunity for young people to have to try out their ability to, I think, make that literature, right? Make that radio literature, literature, voice literature. You know, and I'm sure sometimes cringeworthy, but also sometimes brilliant, you know, and college radio continued to be a place for young journalists to get their start, because college stations, more so than even I think community stations, have held the torch for having some kind of news on air. And even if it's the so-called rip and read, where they're pulling stories off a wire rather than necessarily doing all that strict reporting, having that practice of trying to lend some coherence, even in a 4 or 5 minute newscast, to the events of the day is something that, again, nearly disappeared from the FM airwaves outside of public radio. So yet college students have had the opportunity to do that in college radio.
The Earth's largest community radio station that has ever existed is now on the air and it's podcasting, but it's wildly diffused.
Yes.
It's right. Everywhere and nowhere.
It's
a million voices all at once and no one's listening to all of them, but somebody's listening to everything. It's amazing.
Exactly. And, you know, the opportunity to find an audience is enormous. But the task is you have to find the audience.
They will not find you.
They will not click a dial
and
hear you.
Paul and I talked about this offline. We've talked about this on our podcast and our radio program. It's a really, really unique and I'm going to say pernicious myth of podcasting that gets covered. It keeps popping up. Like there was a New York Times article this month.
Oh my goodness.
About how sad it is when a podcaster doesn't succeed. I just talked to someone in a private conversation with someone who'd invested a huge amount of their nonprofit's resources in building a podcast, and they didn't get the audience they wanted, and that everyone's shocked.
And the thing
when
is
the audience doesn't.
Often I don't know what people consider to be success.
That was the thing.
I do think it's a very vague notion.
100 people is pretty good, guys.
And nobody talks. And that's the funny thing, though. If you go to a college station or a community radio station,
right,
there is consideration often of audience. They want to be sure that you're making something for people, for listeners, right? And that there is some evidence that there are people who might want to hear this program or benefit from it, or that you're serving people in your community. And many times in community radio stations, this is defined by the fact that you might be serving a language minority. You might be serving people who are very much into a particular niche of music that's way outside of the mainstream of American pop and rock music. You know, or can be towards information, can be where we want to do a program on labor affairs or environmental affairs.
Well, this is what you're saying right now. I don't know if you finished your thought, but a radio station exists in one place.
Right.
And that's its superpower. And when a talk program gets on the air in that one place, it is so local and focused that it feels like you're doing the right thing when you're focused on this community.
I think so,
this
right.
small place. And a podcast exists on the in the entire known universe, and it feels like you're failing if you talk about your one city block.
Right. And that's a wonderful point, because I think then sometimes the success of a show on a radio station is judged because you know the people who are listening.
Yeah.
Right. It's not unusual for stations to have a presence at a farmer's market and all sorts of community events where they're talking to people. And if you heard five people come up and tell you how much they love the station, you consider that a success.
And you figure that those five people represent some multiplier, that there's more strangers out there.
And they probably do.
There.
And that's not a bad assumption, right? Or if you get those three phone calls.
It's kind of a nightmare of podcasting, of the lonely podcaster, because the lonely radio producer can always dream that there's someone out there.
And may get a phone call.
Yeah.
Right?
But the lonely podcaster knows the number.
Because it's not live. And you don't have a phone, typically, that you're giving out.
And but also, you literally know the number.
Yeah.
You know that today
from
was 12.
From your podcast host.
And that's... And 12... And knowing that it's 12, knowing that it's 8, knowing that it's 32, not 3,800. And, you know, it's so funny because you mentioned it too. Some podcasts probably have 3,800 listeners and they consider themselves to be utter disgraces because they had planned
because
on being 30 million.
Because they're comparing themselves to either one, podcasters who ended up being very lucky. And, yeah. and it feels like
podcasters who launched from a massive public radio platform like this American
right, or,
Life.
But I really mean, but either, yeah, launching from a platform where there's money promotion behind it, where people already know your name, people already heard of you.
Yeah.
But I'm also talking about, I think sometimes they look at the podcasters who were lucky.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes lightning
strikes.
Yeah,
those are the myth makers.
The people who started out just like you and I with a microphone somewhere and some skill and some chutzpah and
somehow
ended up
somehow they
a
had
audience.
A network, and that network grew fast.
But well, that's confirmation bias, because what you're not looking at is the hundreds and thousands of people who didn't do that. And so, many of whom, right, may still be podcasting along very happily with their audience of hundreds or a few thousand, and you don't know about them because they are niche. They're below the surface. The people who love what they do know about them, but you don't know about them because they don't get articles written about them. They don't show up in charts such as they are. They aren't associated with a bigger name.
Right. Yeah, we didn't even talk about how the charts are structured for a kind of international or a national framework.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, I think people understand it with regard to music. Like, you know, they would talk often, you know, like the Velvet Underground is now a very influential band, but never were on the Billboard charts.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you can say the same thing about lots of artists, musical artists who now enjoy kind of,
I guess our point,
big reputations, but who never sold enough records to be on a chart.
One point, friends, is if you're podcasting, please adjust expectations and be proud of the work. And I mean, I think about we had an episode probably last year. I'll look up the number later, but we talked to a podcast that had a listenership under 100 people. And the point of talking to them, because it was all about tabletop games that were launching on Kickstarter, and for that community, of that community, by that community, that number was great. And they continued to do the work, proud of themselves and comfortable in their success. And about 100, you know, 75 people was fine. And there needs to be more people in the world that podcast with that expectation.
And that and I think the more that people talk about it being okay and being great, but you know, that's sort of our long run up, because it is, because you know what I started off saying, that you know, it's a great boon and opportunity for College of Community Radio, because I think it's a great opportunity, one, to simply make your programming more accessible. Okay. When you have talk programming on your radio station and you do a program, it's ephemeral.
Yeah.
It's gone the minute you turn off the microphones. If you record it and make it a podcast, you now have the opportunity to reach many more listeners.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous opportunity that still isn't exploited enough. Second, often on college and community radio stations, there isn't enough airtime for everybody who's interested in being involved. So it's an opportunity for stations to help people kind of learn the craft through podcasting so that he might be on air, or develop an entirely another channel, community podcasting, as we've talked about before here on Radio Survivor. I think that's another great unexploited opportunity.
For producers to get their reps in, because you know, every hour that you spend in
and
front
by
of
reps
the
you mean like repetition.
Yeah.
Like every, reps in the gym.
Every I'm thinking about I came from an improv community a minute ago where that's what they talked about, where you needed to make sure that when you were studying, you got on stage once a week in front of any audience.
It's like the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours.
You got it. So yeah, people need time in front of a microphone talking to other people to develop a comfort level and a set of skills that make them better at the work of broadcasting.
And a radio station can develop, you know, is a platform. It's not, you know, yes, it's a transmitter and a stream of either online or through the radio airwaves of programming, but also increasingly their websites that people look to for information, for community calendars, for news. And so adding podcasting to the mix is a supplement. It grows your service. It grows the number of people who might be able to benefit because they don't use radio or they can't use radio the way that your station works because the schedule for them is difficult to navigate.
Or they don't live in your neighborhood, but they're a part of your community.
Right. They might live in the fringe of your reception area, and internet listening may not just simply work for them because they can't tune into a live stream.
But they're still local. But they still want the local content.
Yeah. Or they might be formally local.
Or they have no radio.
Or they might be formally local. Yeah. People who have ties to your community who may have moved away but would still like to be in touch, or who are away temporarily, or there may be a very big interest community in your local community that has tendrils that go out all over the place that could be around music, arts, culture, and all these things. And it can tie folks together in a way that the air signal and even the internet signal, if it's live streaming, doesn't quite work for. Imagine somebody who lives, you know, in Australia, who wants to stay in touch with programming back on the continental U.S. The time difference can make it difficult to keep up with it live. But podcasting gives you that opportunity to stay in touch, and we see this happening now with commercial radio, iHeartRadio, Entercom, which is the number four biggest radio station owner in the country. Cumulus, the number two owner of radio stations in the country.
Companies that we've talked about on Radio Survivor in the past because of their size, their debt load, and their...
Not all of them have debt load.
Their negative impact on the culture of radio.
Some of them have negative impact, yes. Some of these companies.
Some.
They are all making big investments in podcasting right now. iHeartRadio recently, within the last year, bought the network called How Stuff Works and has grown what they call the iHeart Podcast Network.
I just saw them plugging a podcast on one of my late night TV habits.
They made it on. They sent around this podcast to all of the late night TV shows.
Yeah.
Because he's an A-minus
list celebrity. Exactly. It's Ron Burgundy, guys.
Yes.
Which is funny. The Radio Survivor connection to Ron Burgundy is that when they were promoting the initial film
Anchorman,
before he became a podcast celebrity, Ron Burgundy, played by Will Ferrell, they sent around the cardboard cutout to every college radio station.
And they still lurk.
And yeah, so
you'll see these photos.
Jennifer
Waits, Survivor.
Occasionally, Jennifer Waits is not a jet setter, but every time Jennifer Waits goes somewhere, Jennifer visits a college radio station, and more often than not, we'll find a Ron Burgundy cutout, either dressed up in a hat or a lei, or somehow ensconced in the college radio community, just sort of lurking in the background. And what a horrifying viral marketing campaign that turned out to be—a long vision viral marketing campaign for iHeartRadio's.
Before the idea had ever hatched.
12-year gestation period for a successful viral marketing campaign that is still yet to. Anyway, I'm being sarcastic.
But Entercom, which is a number four owner, just completed their purchase
of radio stations.
Their purchase of Cadence 13, which they owned a part of, which is a company that sells podcast advertising, is now producing podcasts.
Wow. So that was all the big roll up today for 27 minutes on Radio Survivor. We've been talking about.
I really wanted to be in context.
Yeah,
I don't want people
podcasts.
To think that we're covering podcast industry news for its own sake.
But it's yet another big story.
Well, and I want to say a little more
Yeah, but just putting it in more context, is that a large radio company